Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you think of when you picture Hollywood? For many of us, the image that springs immediately to mind is that famous sign of white letters perched unevenly across Mount Lee in Southern California. But the developer who erected the entertainment industry's best-known symbol did not set out to celebrate movie-making at all. So why did the world come to embrace it as a symbol of glamour, fame, and fortune? Cultural historian Leo Brody is professor of English and American Literature at the University of Southern California. His new book is called The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. Leo, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
So we have this image known all over the world now, and yet, unlike other great monuments, if you can call it that, this doesn't specifically represent any particular event or any person. What exactly does the Hollywood sign stand for?
Well, that's the interesting part of it. It's a very peculiar kind of icon, a very peculiar kind of symbolic sign, because it's only a word. And because it's only a word, people can fill it with whatever meaning they would like. I mean, if it were something like the Statue of Liberty, most icons represent something, but the Hollywood sign, all it is a bunch of letters.
So it means whatever we want it to mean.
I think that's true, and that's sort of part of the whole idea of aspiration, almost, to be famous, to be in Hollywood. People are constantly wanting to have their pictures taken with the Hollywood sign in the background. It's sort of part of personal meaning as much as it is a larger meaning.
I've always found it fascinating that the design of the sign is so simple and so low-tech, given the sort of glamour that we associate with Hollywood.
Well, it was originally put up as an advertisement, as a sort of a species of billboard, really, for Hollywood Land, which was a development right underneath the sign. Which is still there. Even the real estate office is still there. Even though most of the plots, of course, have been many times sold over the years. But it was just there. It was purely utilitarian. It was put up with sheet metal. It was put up on telephone poles that were sunk into the ground. And it was just there for a temporary sign, but somehow over the years it's managed to become very permanent.
And it was not even the first development to be advertised that way.
No, there were other developments. It was very common, in fact, to advertise developments that way in Los Angeles in the early 1920s. This was probably the first one that had so big a sign. Most of them were regular, more familiar kinds of billboards. But this sign, one of the main developers, Harry Chandler, who was also the publisher of the Los Angeles Times and editor-in-chief, said, "I want it to be visible from Wilshire," which was several miles away. Of course, at that point, that street, which is now, of course, filled with businesses and hotels and all sorts of modern conveniences of one sort or another, was really almost a dirt road through the oil fields. But this was a time of a great real estate boom in Los Angeles, the early 1920s, and so they really wanted this sign to be very visible. It actually had light bulbs in it originally.
And they turned out to be too expensive to maintain.
Too expensive to maintain. They, for a while the buying in Hollywood Land was hot, a fellow named Albert Cote lived in a little shack behind the Hollywood sign, and he was the one who would replace the light bulbs. There were 40,000 of them.
Sounds like a horrible job.
Terrible.
You know, what's fascinating, and I love the chapter that you call Hollywood Before Hollywood, Hollywood itself did not consciously set out to attract the film industry.
Not at all. Hollywood, when it was first laid out in the late 1880s, was meant to be a kind of enclave, a suburb for rich people who wanted to grow their gardens and stay away from the city. Even though the city was comparatively young at that point, it was still a place to escape from. So Hollywood had trees and flower gardens and all sorts of very high-toned things. And in addition to that, it was also a temperance utopia. There was no drinking allowed. It was a place, again, a place of refuge from the mess of the cities.
And among the ordinances that the city of Hollywood had, or the incorporated village, I guess, no pool halls, no slaughterhouses, no glue factories.
Exactly. Nothing that smelled bad or made a lot of noise.
So before Hollywood Land came along and this really heavy development began, it was what, like a little sleepy backwater?
To a great extent, and that's the way it's described. That's the way Charlie Chaplin describes it when he first sees it. It's the way a lot of the early stars who happened to come to Hollywood, kind of looked at it, this sleepy village. It was mainly the biggest thing in town was the Hollywood Hotel, which was a place where people would come to stay while they were looking for real estate. The real draw of the early Hollywood were those gardens that I mentioned. There was a French artist named Paul de Longpre who had very famous gardens. And Hollywood at that point, what it was really interested in doing was competing with the Tournament of Roses in Pasadena. Hmm. It wanted to become another flowery garden suburb.
And as the film industry came, at first it was just sort of a place to go in the winter when it was too dark and cold to shoot outside in the Northeast.
Well, that was part of it, and also to escape the Edison Trust. Mm-hmm. The Edison Trust, which was coming around and trying to take away equipment and things like that and stop any filmmaking that was not paying them a premium in one way or another. So it was a double thing. It was an escape from the East Coast where the Edison Trust was much more prevalent and had much more power, and it was escape to a place where you could shoot almost 365 days a year because of the sunshine.
How influential was Charlie Chaplin in moving the entire film industry west?
Well, he was very influential in a variety of ways there. And I think one of the most interesting things in terms of Hollywood itself was that his studio, I mean, there were sort of temporary studios and temporary places to shoot. Cecil B. DeMille shot The Squaw Man in a barn in the middle of Hollywood, sort of off to the side there. The city fathers were not really very happy about that. But Chaplin came in and wanted to plant a studio right there in the middle of Hollywood. And it's still there. It's now the home of the Jim Henson puppets. And on top of the gateway to the studio is Kermit the Frog dressed as Charlie Chaplin. But it was a problem still. You know, there was a lot of opposition. You read the newspaper articles, a lot of opposition to it. But it was finally okayed. With the proviso that it had to not look like a movie studio. So if you're coming to L.A. and coming to Hollywood and on La Brea Avenue, you can see this kind of collection of what looks like, you know, the main street of a little English village, and that's the studio. It shouldn't look like anything negative, anything connected to the movie industry. That was the only way it could be accepted at that point. That was about 1916, 1917.
And was the idea then that actors were sort of unsavory characters to have hanging around?
Very much so. There used to be signs in both Los Angeles and Hollywood with the occasional rooming house that would say no Jews, actors, or dogs allowed.
Goodness.
It was, you know, it was a very prejudiced area, and actors, you know, all outsiders, and actors were one of them, were considered to be verboten.
So why was the sign not taken down? Initially, it was just to celebrate this place called Hollywood Land that was being built. Why wasn't it taken down after most of that development was sold out?
Well, it's very high on a hill. It's very hard to get to. Mm-hmm. And I think it was probably too expensive to take down. So they just sort of let it deteriorate. It was put up in 1923. And by 1939, maintenance on it had stopped entirely. And it was, you know, because it was sheet metal, because it was meant to be temporary, it was just buffeted by wind and rain and everything that happened, and the letters were getting tattered and falling down. And finally, by 1949, the City Parks and Recreation Department wanted to tear the whole thing down and themselves said it was a menace. And at that point, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce stepped in and said, well, okay, we'll take care of it. Because there was a glimmering of an idea that it might represent something at that point, something other than the real estate development that it was.
And that was when the final four letters, L-A-N-D, came off.
Yes, they were knocked down, and so it just said Hollywood. Of course, there are various movies that have more fantastic and melodramatic explanations for this. There's a dirigible crashes into it in Rocketeer and things. Japanese planes attack it in 1941, and the land falls off.
Now, we also know Hollywood. Part of its mythos is that it's this land of broken dreams, which I guess contributes to one of the great legends associated with the sign. Can you tell us the popular story of the actress Peg Entwistle and then talk about what you actually discovered?
Well, the popular story is, and the story that was in all the newspapers in 1932, was that Peg Entwistle, a young actress, had committed suicide by jumping from the H. Her body was found there, her pocketbook with a suicide note in it. And the usual story that's told was that it was because she was frustrated in her efforts to become an actress, a movie actress, had been turned down for a job, and in fact decided to commit suicide for that. So it became a kind of cautionary tale just about the lure of Hollywood the lure of the sign, the lure of you know, the dream of being famous, essentially. But when I started looking into it, it seemed very sort of implausible. Now, I haven't come up with an alternate solution, but I've just basically tried to cast some doubt on that traditional story. For one thing, she lived far away. She lived way down at the foot of the canyon with her uncle. And to climb up to the sign from there, it's just very difficult. It's like you have to go up 2,000 feet, let alone several miles. It's very steep. If you've ever been around the sign, you know that walking there is really treacherous. It's so steep, and the ground is covered with chaparral and cactus, and it's almost like walking in a desert. It's so sandy. It's so hard to get a foothold in it. That nobody noticed her, that nobody saw her as she was walking up here, walking up these crowded streets, walking up streets actually that have no sidewalks. So it's weird to see somebody walking in this area. It makes the whole thing seem very dubious, the whole scenario as it's laid down in the popular story. Another thing is that her suicide note doesn't say one word about this. Doesn't say one word about Hollywood, doesn't say one word about the movie industry. It talks about something. She says, I'll paraphrase, I should have done this a long time ago to save everybody the pain. Well, in fact, if it had anything to do with the movie, she had just been in a movie about 2 or 3 months before, a movie with starring Myrna Loy called 13 Women. And it was unclear. You have different stories in different trade papers. RKO may very well have picked up her option for that. There was no question about it. And in any case, she was a stage actress. She was in a lot of plays. She was with the Theater Guild in New York. So the idea that at this point that she would be upset or want to kill herself because she has not made it in the movie business seems very dubious.
Was she a good actress?
Well, it's very hard to tell. She was an ingenue. She got good notices. I read a lot about the plays that she was in the New York papers and in the L.A. papers. She was in a play with Humphrey Bogart in Los Angeles not too long before this. On Billy Burke, she got good notices when she was noticed. She was, sort of a minor character actress, a young character actress, and a little ingenue.
But there's something irresistible about that story as Absolutely. It's been passed down.
Absolutely. I think of her in some sense as the presiding genius of my book because she is the one, at least in the story, who sees the sign symbolically, sees this otherwise sign that nobody is paying any attention to because it's just this real estate sign. And remember, when she jumps off of it, it doesn't say Hollywood. It still says Hollywood Land at that point. But she, at least the way people tell her story, they're telling a story about the way Hollywood is viewed, and she's just a kind of minor character in that viewpoint.
Were people already using the word Hollywood to denote the film industry in 1932?
Oh, yes. It was very widespread by that point. One of the intriguing things about it is that the word Hollywood starts to be the word for the movie business in the early 1920s, just around the time that Hollywood Land is developed and the sign goes up. It's both positive and negative. There are a lot of scandals in Hollywood in the early 1920s, the Fatty Arbuckle scandal that many people have heard of. Mm-hmm. But then there's the murder of William Desmond Taylor, who was three times the head of the Directors Guild, that Mabel Normand and Mary Miles Minter and other stars of the time were somehow smeared with. Wallace Reed, who was a very handsome hunk star of that period, had died in a... in a drug asylum. So there were a lot of scandals. Hollywood was negative and Hollywood was positive.
My guest this hour is cultural historian Leo Brody. He's professor of English and American Literature at the University of Southern California. His new book is called The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is cultural historian Leo Brody. He teaches English and American literature at the University of Southern California. His new book is called The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So at what point, Leo, did the movie industry itself and later the television industry start to pick up on the image and actually include it in things that it was producing?
Well, it starts really in the 30s. You don't see the sign very much in silent films. It's not there at all, really. But it's very sporadic. Say there's a film in 1936 called Hollywood Boulevard, and to set the scene, there's a little montage at the beginning. And the sign is in that montage, but also the Chinese Theater is in that montage, the Brown Derby, and other kinds of places in Hollywood. In fact, if you think about it, look at all the films that have the sign in it in any way, it's very minor player. It doesn't have that symbolic power that we give it now. The Chinese Theater, again, is much more prevalent, and the Brown Derby, the place where all the Hollywood stars hung out, they supersede the sign by many, many appearances.
It is interesting, though, later on, wasn't it I Love Lucy, where there are shots of that when Lucy and Ricky move out to L.A.?
Oh, yeah. I mean, by the 1950s, it is definitely established as a place marker. When, you see the sign, you're in Hollywood. But in the 1930s, it doesn't have that kind of symbolic significance. It's really after it becomes Hollywood in 1949, after the land is loped off, that it starts to build some kind of iconic power.
In the 1940s, who owned the land around the sign?
Well, it's really the city owned the land, except for this little chunk, and this was a problem that came up very recently, last year, in 2010. There was a chunk behind the sign that the city somehow never managed to buy, and was owned by Howard Hughes. And Howard Hughes was going to build a love nest for himself and Ginger Rogers there. But then he got all the variances, and he could, and all the utilities could come in, and he had an access road, et cetera. But Ginger Rogers dumped him. She said later that she didn't want to be locked away as one of his girlfriends, and moved to Oregon, actually. And that land lay fallow for many years until the first decade of of our century,
right.
a Hollywood, now I'm getting all confused again, a Chicago realty firm bought up that land, said it was going to build luxury housing on that land, and they bought it, I think, for like $2 million and put it on the market for $20 million. Got everybody all crazy, got the city all crazy, got the Trust for Public Land to intervene there. And finally, $12 million was raised to buy that land, the last million coming from Hugh Hefner, who had helped the sign in the 70s. And so now that whole area is really city land.
And the issue was that this would have ruined the view of the sign if there were a bunch of condos or mansions behind it.
Well, exactly. I mean, to see housing behind the sign, part of the appeal of the sign is its isolation.
Yeah.
Its separateness. I mean, it has those radio and microwave and TV towers on top of it, but that sort of adds to its mystique.
Do you see a sort of symbolism that many people have tried to get up there and very few people can?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the inaccessibility of the sign is like the inaccessibility of becoming famous, of becoming a star, of going Hollywood, and trying to climb up there. It's very steep. It's a very steep climb. It's very difficult to get to. I mean, the sign is, again, very different from a lot of other icons. We can visit the Eiffel Tower. You can certainly look at Mount Rushmore. You can get to the Statue of Liberty. They're much more accessible. The sign's inaccessibility is almost a symbolic counter for the inaccessibility of what it represents.
It is, I guess, is it trademark protected or copyright protected? What the formation of the letters is something that you
well,
can't...
it's an interesting question because it's an interesting legal or copyright question. Actually, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce it owns the copyright to the sign, but what it owns is not the word Hollywood, is not even the image of the sign on a hill, because that's a geographic marker and that can't be copyrighted. What it owns is the way the letters are presented. the kind of screwy slide way the letters are presented there. It's, you know, it's not, and that's, of course, one of the most appealing things about the sign. It's not like a billboard. It's not flat across. It's not two-dimensional. It has that three-dimensionality to it. So if anybody tries to do that, then the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce brings out their lawyers. But if you just put Hollywood in something, or let's say in so many shows, as you mentioned, I Love Lucy, or recent shows like NCIS Los Angeles, or you know some of the other shows that are set in Los Angeles, you can have a shot of the sign, but that's not copyrighted because you're just pointing to a geographic place.
It does seem surprising, and I know there's very expensive real estate sort of somewhat below it, but that somebody didn't come up with like a monorail or something, a tramway to make money off this thing.
Well, it is surprising, but I mean, if you talk to the neighbors there, they don't want any of that because it's a warren of very tangly streets. And actually, the fire department often weighs in on this, too. Very recently, there were signs that said this way to the Hollywood sign. There used to be, there still are signs that say no access to the Hollywood sign. Mm-hmm. And then they started putting up a few signs to say this is the way to the Hollywood sign. And they were all sawn down by neighbors and destroyed there, too. So it's very dangerous is the argument to have too many people coming up there. There's no parking. There's no real way to get around. There are hikers up there. There are joggers up there. But that's a lot easier.
And people don't stop trying to get up there.
Oh no, they don't stop trying. Just the way people don't stop trying, to be on American Idol or Dancing with the Stars or shows like that. You know, people have that aspiration.
I guess another reason for restricting access is that the sign has been really dramatically altered, temporarily altered over the years for purposes of making particular statements.
Yes, and that's the alteration of the sign is another interesting moment in the sign's history. I mentioned that in 1949 it became Hollywood rather than Hollywoodland, and that was an important moment. I think the next really important moment is in 1973, when a young man named Danny Feingood, who's taking a class in public sculpture at Cal State Northridge in the San Fernando Valley, as a project, takes two pieces of white material and two pieces of black material and goes up there and changes Hollywood to Hollyweed. And the reason that he does that is that the state legislature of California had just recently decriminalized marijuana. So this kind of, all of a sudden, the sign has changed. And I think that's an important moment because Danny Feingood, you know, is an artist. He's taking this class in sculpture. And he sees the sign, instead of as a word, he sees it as something plastic, something malleable, something that can be changed. And he sees it as an art object.
It must have been amazing for people to wake up the morning that that happened and see the changes.
Yeah, I think people were really startled. But then, it gave a lot of people ideas. And over the years, the sign, you know, would be used in the USC-UCLA rivalry. It was Perotwood twice when Ross Perot was running. It was Hollywood when Oliver North was giving his testimony in the Iran-Contra affair. It was Hollywood on an Easter week once. I mean, just many, many kinds of variations. Although they have really stopped. I mean, it's very hard to get into where the sign is now. There are fences, there are motion detectors, there are TV cameras.
So let's talk about the late 70s. The sign had once again sort of fallen into disrepair, and it was crumbling. And this to me, sounds like either a trivia question or a really bad joke. What do Hugh Hefner, Alice Cooper, and Andy Williams have in common?
Right. Exactly. It was falling into disrepair. Since the 1949 lopping off of the land, there was a lot of patching done, and every time it was done, they said this would make the sign more permanent. This would fix everything. I mean, here's this temporary structure that was just slapped up here, and people are trying to fix it. So in the early 70s, they did it, and it still, you know, started being blown down and letters falling off or getting tattered. So finally, after there must have been at least four or five committees to save the sign. Finally, in the late 70s. The most decisive thing happened, and it was spearheaded by Alice Cooper and Hugh Hefner to really save the sign, to make the sign permanent, and that is basically to reconstruct the entire sign, not to patch it, but to reconstruct it. Mm-hmm. And the way they did it was to sell letters. That was one of the ways they raised the money. They sold the letters, each letter for $27,777, and Andy Williams bought one of the letters, And it's kind of, it's significant, and Alice Cooper and Hugh Hefner bought letters as well. Alice Cooper bought one in memory of Groucho Marx, who he had been a friend of. And it's significant. Andy Williams, particularly significant. And also Gene Autry, I would add to that trivia question. Because they were the people who bought letters who were the closest in any way to the film business. The film business really could care less about the sign at that point. Andy Williams, of course, as a singer, Gene Autry as the singing cowboy, but at this point, you know, he was owner of the sports team, he was a radio station, he was much more a businessman than he was a movie star. It was really about, and the, many of the other people who bought the letters in the signs were actually Hollywood businessmen. It was more a Chamber of Commerce deal in a way than it was a Hollywood the movie business deal.
So why did they care so much? Why did Hugh Hefner in particular care so much?
Well, I think it's partially, it's the idea of the outsider. That is, the sign means a lot more to people coming to Hollywood, coming to Los Angeles, than it does to people who work here. And it certainly meant a lot more to people who were here in that capacity than it did to people in the movie business. The movie business was, you know, sort of not paying any attention to it at all. Both Hugh Hefner and Alice Cooper had just moved to L.A. a few years before that. They were real newcomers. So the sign was symbolic to them. We started off talking about the way in which we, you could load whatever meaning you want into these words, and it's really the outsiders who have that, that ability to do that. The insiders couldn't really care.
It's also an interesting reflection of the fact that you can buy your way into certain kinds of fame or success or notoriety.
Oh, exactly. It's, you know, that is, you want a piece of it. In fact, when the sign was torn down, the various pieces of it appeared and in stores. I think I've never been able to run across this, but I've seen comments to the fact that the May Company, which is a big department store in Los Angeles, made necklaces with little pieces of the sign or bracelets with little pieces of the old sign embedded in it in Lucite. So, I mean, there's a kind of almost, not quite iconic, but you know, almost religious side to this. You would wear a memento of the sign around your neck.
Now, the original letters were 30 feet wide and 50 feet high, and now they're a little bit shorter. Why is that?
They're 45 feet high now, and I think it's because of the you know, because of the nature of the kinds of materials that were used. The earlier sign was slapped up with these pieces of tin, essentially painted tin. But when they did it, when they redid it, they it was much stronger. It's kind of corrugated cast metal with the paint baked on. And I think just the industrial abilities there, you know, the way architects will use stuff that is pre-made really dictated the size of the letters.
When the recent effort came about to sort of save the sign by making sure that the land around it was kept undeveloped, there were a lot more people who were directly associated with Hollywood involved. Is that
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. By this time, many generations on, you know, people like Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, you know, weighed in with donations there. So this Hollywood, and you know, just kind of proves something about the kind of genealogy of Hollywood and the way Hollywood has developed. And Hollywood has gotten a sense of its own history. I mean, if you look at the work, let's say, of Spielberg and other directors like that, I mean, these are people who know their Hollywood history. And so they're self-conscious about the this symbolic sign in a way that earlier generations were not.
I guess it's also a reflection of the fact that it's okay to think of Hollywood history as a subject for serious consideration.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Los Angeles history as well. And that was very slow in coming. I mean, the whole idea of Los Angeles, in a way, an early Hollywood, was to forget your history, forget the past, you know, start over again, be new, not trammeled or encumbered or burdened by anything that happened before you. But by now, of course, 100 years on, more than 100 years since the beginnings of movies, there's a history there. And Los Angeles itself, really, in the 1960s and 1970s, was only beginning to wake up to the fact that it had a history, that it had significant buildings, and that it had places that shouldn't just be torn down for the next new thing.
Now, Hollywood itself is not a neighborhood of Los Angeles, but a specifically incorporated city. Is that correct?
Well, it's a kind of tenuous legal thing. It is a neighborhood of Los Angeles, but it is treated as if it were a specifically incorporated city. It actually, it was incorporated early on, and then it consolidated with Los Angeles in 1910. Because of, you know, because of its significance in that way, because of the way people think of Hollywood, you know, in quotation marks, its records are kept separate from the records of the city of Los Angeles.
And water has always been an issue.
Water was the reason that it consolidated with Los Angeles. If you look at the movie Chinatown, which is very much about the water problems of Los Angeles, it's set in the 1930s, but it actually it happened at the beginning of the 20th century, and that's when the aqueduct was built to bring water from Northern California, and that's when all the problems were. The consolidation, part of the consolidation was there's so many wooden houses, and it was about fire departments and access to water, too. I mean, when you consolidated with the larger entity of Los Angeles, you got a lot more benefit from it.
Is it still the case, or has always been the case, that, more movies and television shows and different kinds of productions are actually made outside of the little area that is called Hollywood than within it? Is that right?
Yes, I think that's one of the great ironies that I go into in the book. It's, in fact, very few movies were made in Hollywood. Very few studios were in Hollywood. There's a story I think it's in the Chicago Tribune, as I remember, from about 1914 or 1915, which talks about, you know, big headline, the movie-making capital of the world. What's it talking about? It's talking about the San Fernando Valley, where Universal had its studios. There were studios in Culver City for a long time. MGM, as always, now Sony, has always been in Culver City. Santa Monica was the place where Thomas Ince shot his westerns. Edendale, to the east, sort of between downtown L.A. and Hollywood, was where Max Sennett and Tom Mix and all these other studios were. So, I mean, the idea, it's such an ironic, strange thing that the name for all these very disparate places is Hollywood.
Leo Brody is my guest. He's a cultural historian and professor of English and American Literature at the University of Southern California. His new book is called The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. If you've got a question or want to join the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Leo Brody. His new book is called The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. In the book, Leo, you sort of compare and contrast the mystique that has grown up around the Hollywood sign with that of the Eiffel Tower. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that for us.
Well, the Eiffel Tower is the only icon that really extraordinary icon that I think is comparable in any way to the Hollywood sign, because the Eiffel Tower was also meant to be temporary. Mm-hmm. It was just there for the World's Fair. It was actually heartily detested by a lot of Parisians. Emile Zola and other artists and writers signed a petition saying, "Get this piece of junk out of Paris." But somehow, over the years, again, in this very similarly to the Hollywood sign, it sort of gathered significance like a snowball rolling downhill there, and it became people got sentimental about it, and it became the symbol of Paris, just as the Hollywood sign has become the symbol of Hollywood, even though it really has that very little to do with Hollywood in its origins.
So there's that sense that it's an eyesore, but it's our eyesore.
It's our eyesore. It's our icon, exactly.
Do you think that the era has passed when it's possible for something to accidentally take on this kind of significance?
Well, I wonder. It's, you know, some kinds of things, you know, we should try to think of something that's happened fairly recently, but, you know, nothing really comes to mind. Maybe it belongs to a more innocent, a more naive era. where something can be up there. It's just that land like that, if something is built that way, something that is so inaccessible or else can be used for other purposes, and in most places will just be torn down. Things are impermanent. I mean, we have a kind of impermanent society. Our own sense of history is often so poorly developed that we're looking to the future. I mean, this is kind of the idea of progress, the idea of America moving forward all the time, that we forget the past.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what it's like to live in a place where tourists are an everyday part of the landscape and you sort of can't go anywhere without running into people who are there to visit.
Well, it's an odd feeling, too, but it's because it makes you very self-conscious about the place that you live in, too. So you can have either of two reactions. On one hand, it's kind of feel proud that people are coming to look at it. On the other hand, feeling totally annoyed that you're being harassed. So you tend to stay away from those tourist areas. You stay away from, and maybe the same thing happens with Dealey Plaza. That people don't, there's so many tourists going there, and you want to stay away from it. I stay away from Hollywood Boulevard for the same reasons.
And when your students come, I mean, you're teaching English and American literature. I mean, I assume some of them are interested in the entertainment industry, but not all of them. Do they all have a sort of image of L.A. and Hollywood that over the course of a couple of years at USC that changes for them?
Yes, that's an interesting point, because part of it is, and this is something that's true of residents, too, after you come here, because from the outside, you see the glitzy, the glittering Hollywood. You see the kind of cliche Hollywood and the cliche Los Angeles. But when you come here, you start realizing how complicated a place it is, how many different kinds of people are here, how many different kinds of things beside the movie business goes on. I mean, actually, people are surprised to hear, for example, that the largest private employer in Los Angeles is not anything having to do with the movie business, but is in fact USC, the University of Southern California.
Yeah, it's sort of a shame that you don't get credit for being a big university town.
No, exactly. Between USC and UCLA, we have two great universities, but it's not thought of as a university town at all.
What made you decide to take on this project?
Well, in part, it's because I live nearby, because I've always been fascinated by it, but because I've been fascinated by the history of my own neighborhood, my own area, too. And one of the things that I mentioned in the book is how many different kinds of people have come out here, how many different kinds of groups. Along the foothills near the Hollywood sign, there's a whole theosophist community that came in 1910, 1911, 1912 and built places there. There's all sorts of religious groups, all sorts of political groups. I mean, it's an incredible mix here. Just off of Hollywood Boulevard, for example, was the place where a house called Oscott was situated, where L. Frank Baum, the author of the Wizard of Oz books, lived with his family, and where he wrote all the Oz books except the first one.
It's funny, you don't associate him with Southern California. You think he must have lived in Kansas.
Exactly. And also Edgar Rice Burroughs had his place in Tarzana, which is still the name of that community in the San Fernando Valley. I mean, there were all sorts of people were out here early on that you don't expect to be here. Adlai Stevenson was born in Los Angeles, not too far from USC. So, I mean, it's seen as a place where nothing happens except the movies, and in fact, many, many kinds of things happen. I'm actually quite pleased with a lot of the new TV shows because they don't show the Hollywood sign very often. They show other parts of Los Angeles.
Well, I think we here in North Texas, certainly in Dallas, can understand living in a place that is widely misunderstood because of its portrayal in the media.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure the same thing is true of Dallas. That it's a complicated place and that many kinds of things are going on, but people coming from the outside have this kind of tunnel vision about what Dallas means or what Los Angeles means.
And do you think an examination of what it really is has to come from someone who lives there? I mean, sometimes people from outside a particular place sort of dive bomb in and try to understand it and then interpret it for the rest of the world. Do you think a true understanding can only come from people who experience it regularly and for a long amount of time?
I think so, and I think it's certainly a complicated understanding. Would come from that, a much truer understanding. People often, people who let's say, be ashamed to jump into Serbia or Afghanistan or Haiti or something like that, and write a book after 2 weeks' experience. We'll somehow do it about Los Angeles.
What do you think about this? I mean, certainly there was this huge concentration of the entertainment industry around Southern California, at least the film and television industry. Now that technologies are changing and you're having people on much smaller scales producing things that end up before wide audiences, do you have any sense that Hollywood will mean something different at some point if you don't have to be there to make a movie or a TV show?
Well, it's an interesting question because, of course, we have Bollywood in India, and we have Nollywood in Nigeria, and actually Hollywood, both Bollywood and Nollywood produce many more movies than Hollywood does at this point. But the sign is really a node. It's a way of trying to understand a very diffuse business, a very diffuse art, a very diffuse phenomenon. So I think it'll still be the umbrella term in one way or another. That's what it has been established as. There was recently an argument in New Zealand. They wanted to put up a big sign at Wellington, New Zealand, that said Wellywood. And, you know, it was shot down by whoever, the city council or somebody. But there's always that urge. And, you know, I've traveled in Italy or France or, you know, or places like that, and you'll see the Hollywood Bar or something. You know, those kinds of things. It's become a brand name.
We have an email here from John in Fort Worth who is interested to know if you can compare the Hollywood sign to the old RKO broadcast tower. John says, it seems like in 1930 vintage films, they would start with the RKO tower. I saw it driving down Sunset Boulevard and was very impressed.
Yes, well, a lot of those logos in early films, you know, definitely tried to create that, especially, you know, the broadcast tower on top of the world in that way. It was so the sense of branding was very strong in the studios, and I think part of that spills over in Hollywood sign as well.
Leo Berti is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone to Gwen in Dallas. Hello, Gwen.
Hi there. I had two or three things that are sort of Dallas-specific that sort of fill that function a little bit for me. Well, one thing is Big Tex, who, it occurred to me, has kind of a parallel with Jesus in that, you know, he dies every year, and then every year he is resurrected.
Let me have you pause there. Big Tex, Leo, is this very tall figure that shows up at the State Fair of Texas, which is always held in Dallas, or has been for decades now. And so he's this sort of famous icon in Texas.
Oh, yeah. Everyone knows Big Tex here. And I can't remember the name of the restaurant. There was a restaurant on Oak Lawn, and I believe now it's Papado's or, you know, one of those. But they left the sign up. I don't know if it's still up, but for years and years, they left that sign, even though the restaurant was long gone. And it was done very purposefully. And I can't remember. It's at Oak Lawn and I don't remember.
I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but that is an interesting point, Leo, that there are things sort of throughout this country and in our history where the original building is no longer used for the same purpose, but we're so attached to the facade or to the sign that we leave that and then change the function of things.
Yeah, and it's very true in Los Angeles, and it may be true in Dallas as well. I mean, again, all places that are noted for their wide open spaces and for their car cultures, too. That you need these very ostentatious signs, these larger than life things, to catch people's attention, and they become like markers in the landscape. And so even when whatever it is, the donut shop with the enormous donut is no longer a donut shop, you still want to have that donut out there.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Matt in Arlington. Hi, Matt.
Hey, I was wondering who owns the land that the sign is on?
Who owns? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
The land that the sign's
on.
The city of Los Angeles owns the land. Now, that whole area at the city of Los Angeles and maintained by the Parks and Recreation Department. The Hollywood Sign Trust oversees it, and the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce is responsible as well.
I have to imagine those were some glittering fundraising events when they were coming together to purchase that last chunk of land.
Oh, well, they had some great fundraising events up there near the sign with Tom LaBange, our local councilman, who was there, and they had billboards, electronic billboards, all around town with the amount of money and how much money was still to be raised. So, yeah, it was definitely a big push.
Another thing that must be fascinating about living in L.A., occasionally I'll read online the Los Angeles Times, and there are entertainment stories on the front page of this serious newspaper. And I suppose it's not unlike military stories in a military town. But does that take some getting used to?
Well, not really. I mean, they're often very interesting ones, and they, for the most part, they tend to be obituaries, but of famous old stars. But you're right; there is a kind of company town side to it, and it's part of the charm.
What other icons are there in the United States that, even if you wouldn't write about them, you find interesting enough to hope that someone else does do an exploration similar to the one that you did? Have you thought about that?
Well, you know, the Mount Rushmore, of course, is fascinating. I think someone is doing a book in this series of American icons about the Liberty Bell and the Statue of Liberty. Those kinds of places. It would be interesting to find less obtrusive ones, of course. I'm more fascinated with the Hollywood sign because it has such a checkered history, because it has had so many problems on its route to becoming an icon.
No chance that it will ever change at this point, that the trust is a permanent one?
Yes, the trust is a permanent one, and the concrete and the steel in the sign are pretty permanent as well.
Are there still pieces of it for sale on eBay or wherever, the old signs?
I haven't found them. I looked at various times, and I haven't found them yet. People have been in contact with me who have pieces of it, who would like to show it at various things, who bought it at the time. But I don't think anything is for sale at this point.
Was there anything beyond the Peg Entwistle story that you had always heard about the sign that when you looked at it, you found out that the story is not quite what you expected or what you'd been told?
Not really. I mean, a lot of about the sign, there's very little about the sign that's known. I mean, even in L.A., people know two things about the sign. They know that it said Hollywood Land originally, and they know the Peg Entwistle story in some form or another. But otherwise, there's not very much that's said about it. People will tell stories about the sign, people who grew up here. I think Carol Burnett in her autobiography talks about walking up to the sign and seeing it actually in the way that we were discussing it as a kind of symbol of her aspiration there, too. So, I mean, it has meaning for kids, let's say. During this, the 60s, people would go up there and smoke dope and things like that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think people didn't pay much attention to it.
Is it actually less impressive if you do get as close as you're legally allowed to get up on the mountain?
No, I think in some ways it's more impressive. It's really huge, and it's in this very horrible angle there. You actually can see the stubs of the old telephone poles from the prior sign. They're still there, but it's very enormous. And when I hiked down to it from the top, which was no problem, just like sliding down the hill, but hiking back up was an enormous. It was terrible. I had to stop about 10 times to catch my breath.
The new book by cultural historian Leo Brody is called The Hollywood Sign: Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. Leo, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure talking to you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.